WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. That's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Oh, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth, Charlotte Becky. You ready?
I got to tell you that it was really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us. Sir, how are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome and good evening. You are tuned in to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD. My name is Kevin Tachi. I will be with you for, well, it's an abbreviated radio program this evening. As at the top of the hour, we have a political forum. It'll kick off at 7 o'clock. I believe the candidates are the Pembroke Select Board. But we'll kick things right off, get right into the conversation. Time for us to do a little bit of a State House report. And this week, we are privileged to be speaking with State Senator Patrick O'Connor. Senator, welcome back to Monday Night Talk, sir.
Good evening, Kevin. Thank you for having me. Always a pleasure to join you and be able to talk about some of the topics going on in Beacon Hill as well as in the South Shore communities.
Yeah, we got a couple of different areas that we can talk about. We can talk about the legislative session, budgets. We can talk a little bit about some legislation that is in the works in the Senate. And even kind of kicking around in the district. What's going on in the senator's great district. Let's get started and talk a little bit about, the House has done their version of the fiscal 2024 budget. And I believe next up on the docket will be the Senate.
We are. So the House went through their budget debate last week. It actually started a week ago today, last Monday. And they went through 3 days of debate, pretty extensive. They debated 1,500 amendments. They landed on a budget that's $56.2 billion, which I believe is about $700 million more than the budget that Governor Healey had put forward. That typically happens, once the governor releases their budget, it gets to a point in time where that's the baseline, and the House builds upon that. And the Senate, which I expect our budget to be released sometime probably in the next week and a half, usually it's the second or third week of May, our budget will get released. We then have a week to offer amendments, and then we get into budget debate. And our hope and expectation is to continue to grow from that number. I think it's responsible growth. It's not just, just because the line item was lower in the House or lower in the Senate that we automatically have to, make it larger. But, responsible growth and making sure that Massachusetts continues to really be the leader in so many different areas of the things that are important, services to our individuals with disabilities, our veterans, our seniors, making sure that our public education systems are as strong as they can be. And every national report card indicates that Massachusetts is the best public education system. Really digging in deep into some of the issues that were exposed by COVID, in particular, healthcare and inside of that, behavioral and mental health. Making targeted investments to continue to make Massachusetts a better place to live, to work, to raise a family, and to make sure that the quality of life of everyone, is continuously improved. And I have the great honor of serving as the ranking member of the Ways and Means Committee, so that gives me an opportunity to have a seat at the table to make sure that the specific priorities for the South Shore and the things that people on the South Shore care about statewide are addressed at a really intimate level with the folks who are the budget writers in the state.
You correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that the fiscal 23 budget was somewhere between 48 and 49 billion. It seems as though this new budget has ballooned. As you mentioned, the new administration put forth a $55 billion piece of legislation, and going through the House process is up to 56. Do you think that the Senate will kind of stay around 56, or could it balloon a little bit more?
It's tough to tell. My guess would be we probably would increase it somewhere around $200 to $300 million, but that's just off of sort of historical data in the past as far as where the Senate usually takes the budget. And it is an increase, but just like every household budget right now, the cost of doing business and the cost of living and the cost of goods and the cost of employment and the cost of everything is just going through the roof. And so we need to keep up with the times and make sure that individuals who provide crucial safety net services to the state are paid more equitably. You know, a lot of the things that we've been really fighting for a long period of time, as far as making sure that people have as much opportunity in Massachusetts as possible. Well, that opportunity costs a significant amount of money. But the good thing is Massachusetts is still in an era of prosperity. Last year, we were able to return $3 billion in taxpayer money back to them in the form of a 14% break on their state income taxes. And I expect that this year will be in pretty good shape when the end of the year hits, that, you know, we'll be able to continue to add to our record stabilization fund, which is, you know, at around $10 billion now. You know, we have the reserves in place. The industries that we've invested in, like biotech and healthcare and others throughout Massachusetts, high technology, continue to improve and continue to garner record success. And, you know, we're at a stage right now where I think we can make targeted investments into the things that people really care about, and also into things, as I said before, that, you know, we were not doing well. I don't think that going into COVID, we were doing mental health well. I think that low-income school districts, you know, weren't getting the supports that they need, but now through the Student Opportunity Act, they are. So we have this opportunity to really invest in the core things that, you know, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat or independent or wherever you fall on the political spectrum, that you can say, yeah, those are investments that we should be making. Those are things that we should be doing. And, you know, that's why I'm proud to be from Massachusetts and in the legislature to be able to talk and suggest and provide ideas to how to continue to move Massachusetts in the right direction. Because over the past few years, with chaos up on or down on Capitol Hill and throughout so many state capitals across the nation, Massachusetts has kept its head high. We've worked in a bipartisan way. And I think you see the results in the success that Massachusetts has had on so many fronts.
Interesting you mentioned about education. I know labor force is something that is built into this bill that this administration wants to, you know, individuals 25 or older, if they want to get a college degree, whether it's at you know, more so at a two-year school than going for a bachelor's degree, that there's money built in to her budget or their budget. Do you feel that the Senate is going to embrace this initiative?
Yeah, so the Senate president has already said that this is something that she wants to do. The Senate president actually wants to go a little bit further and say that anyone over the age of 18 could be able to go to a community college and get that associate's degree or get that education for free. I don't know if that's something that we're going to be able to do in this budget, but making the steps that we're making right now to make community college free for anyone over the age of 25, I think it's phenomenal. We are in a, you know, we have a major labor crisis right now that's going on in Massachusetts. We can't find enough employees to fill critical roles, whether they be nurses or whether they be individuals for human services, or even just in general. You know, most companies are running right now, the MBTA, most companies right now are running, you know, with the expectation that they're going to be able to bring more people on board. But because of a multitude of reasons, you know, we haven't been able to do that. And it's not, you know, I know that some people have said, you know, it's because of some of the federal benefits that are been given out or things like that. All that stuff has dried up. And our unemployment rate is incredibly low. And so now it's what else can we do to continue to upskill and equip our workforce with the best possible tools that they can have and give them the opportunities that they may not have had otherwise to be able to go out in Massachusetts, be competitive, make a good wage, raise a family, be able to retire, have the benefits that everyone deserves. And this is going to be a key part of that. I think that it's really good. And I know that there's always an element, and we hear it from time to time from people that, you know, are saying, well, I paid for college, or, you know, I paid for my kids' colleges, and this shouldn't be, you know, free. I think that that's more on the federal level as far as loan forgiveness goes. This is really trying to find people who may not have been able to find their way when they were 18, 19, 20, 21, or got into a profession that they don't like. And now this gives them an opportunity at a second chance. And that second chance is going to be funded by the state. And it also helps our goals and achieves, you know, solutions to some of the problems that are facing the state, specifically in the labor market, which is incredibly, incredibly, incredibly tight right now.
A colleague of yours in the legislative delegation on the South Shore here in the House is put forth a pilot bill in regards to a four-day work week. You think that's something that also could be, could have a, there could be a discussion in the Senate about, and that could be something that could entice folks to want to stay here in Massachusetts, especially if there are companies that are willing to sign on to such a program?
Yeah, I know that some companies have signed on, not from Massachusetts, but some companies internally did the four-day work week test. I think the future of work is drastically changed from what it was. And you see it in Boston. Luckily, I think Boston's picking back up. You see it in the State House where, you know, for a long period of time, there was literally a ghost town. But now it's starting to pick up. And so as this is starting to pick up, we have an opportunity to really reimagine what work looks like. And, you know, I'm all for a pilot program. I don't know. I'd have to really dig into it. And to be perfectly honest with you, I haven't yet. But I think it's good and healthy that we're having discussions as far as what is going to make Massachusetts competitive towards younger individuals that we want to then have them enter the workforce. I think that the four-day work week isn't the biggest challenge we have. I think that making more workforce housing and making sure that people can afford to live near or close or in the community that they work in. I think that making sure that people aren't saddled with debt and that people are paid a livable wage, that they have benefits, all the things that have been fought for all of these years, you know, that we now have a good balance on. I think that that's going to be the bigger challenge that we have than enticing people with a four-day work week is going to be making sure that people can actually afford to live in Massachusetts.
Ken, if you're just tuning in, you're tuned in to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD. And we're privileged to be speaking with the State Senator Patrick O'Connor, talking about the latest going on budget, even talking a little bit about what's going on for legislation to be filed. Are there a couple of bills that are in your wheelhouse, something that either you are a primary that you authored or you're co-sponsoring that you want to take a couple moments to talk about?
I'd love to, and thank you, Kevin. So we filed 138 bills this year. I serve on 18 different committees, so I have a large amount of subject matter that I need to dig into, you know, every single day. And so one of the things that we've been really, I think, very successful at doing is hearing from constituents and talking to them and seeing what their concerns are, what their hopes are, you know, what their fears are, and what's happened to them in personal experiences and what the state can do better. And the best example of that we've been able to do is we talked to a family in Weymouth whose son was abused in a group home who had disabilities, and we were able to make a registry in place to ensure that those people who applied for other jobs after they were caught abusing her son, that they are no longer able to work with vulnerable populations. And that literally organically happened from a woman, Ann Joyce, coming into our office and talking to us and trying to institute change to make sure what happened to her son never happens to anyone else. The same things have happened this past year, where we had the Shea family come in from Scituate, who talked about their 19-year-old son who passed away from an overdose. And basically, they knew the individuals who supplied the drugs to their son, and they wanted to make sure that Massachusetts had laws on our books that we could actually go after people like that. And we looked at other states. About half the nation has passed laws called drug-induced homicide laws, which put penalties in place and gives district attorneys and law enforcement officials tools to be able to go after mid to high-level drug dealers. And I wanted to see what was good in what other states had done and what was bad. And what we saw in some of the bad was that a lot of states were criminalizing addiction. We didn't want to do that. We didn't want to go after good Samaritans who were, you know, calling in overdoses. And so we, throughout this bill, tried to incorporate the best practices from all the other states. And one of the things we do is we don't have a minimum mandatory associated with this. What we do is we give judges discretion. We have a review board to make sure that there's no prejudice being used in this. And we also have a specific carve out for anyone who themselves are suffering with addiction, that they are not charged with this. And so our goal is to basically go after mid to high level drug dealers. Because right now, if there was a drug overdose and that resulted in death, and the police were to investigate this, or the police knew that the individual who supplied this drug, which predominantly is fentanyl now, which is an absolute contamination of our communities, if they were able to trace this back to a person who they knew was a regional dealer all throughout the South Shore and into the Cape, there's no tool right now, and there's nothing on the books to actually allow for our law enforcement and our district attorneys to press charges against that person. They've tried it in the past, where they've tried manslaughter and other specific degrees of murder, and they haven't worked. The courts have thrown them out. What we need is something on the books to give our district attorneys the tools that they need to go after these people who are poisoning our communities. And what this bill does is open up that opportunity by producing a drug-induced homicide law in Massachusetts.
And that's open, if I'm correct, that is Senate Bill 1095?
It is.
Okay. We're short on time, but I want to make sure we talk a little bit about the wiretap bill. Can we talk about that a little bit? That is Senate Bill 1093.
Yeah, so we had an individual who was a survivor of domestic violence who, had recorded their abuser. And in that period of time that they recorded their abuser, it was used against this individual because in Massachusetts, you need two-party consent. So, under a hypothetical situation, if you were to record an individual who was abusing you, who were making threats against you, you can't use that in a court of law. And instead of being able to use that in a court of law, they actually slapped 8 felony counts of wiretap violation on this individual. And I just thought to myself, how illogical is this? And also, how much does this prevent victims and from wanting to go forward of domestic violence if the courts and the law is stacked against them, that if they record them and then try and use that, then they themselves are going to be charged with felonies? So this bill, which we wrote in conjunction with District Attorney Tim Cruz, basically allows for secret audio and visual recordings when they're made specifically to record threats, harassment, or other crimes related to domestic violence. And I think that it's very cut and dry. It's very simple. Our wiretap laws have not been updated since the early 1960s. We've actually gone to the moon since the time in which we updated our wiretap laws. We have, in addition to that, not just this problem, but many problems inside of our wiretap laws. We've tried to update them. We have other bills associated with wiretap, but most importantly, we want to fix this because this is government's responsibility to protect victims of domestic violence. And if a person comes forward and they have a recording and that recording shows that they've been abused or the threats are being made against them, they shouldn't get punished for that. They should be able to utilize that in our judicial system. And this is just one of the things of many that, although Massachusetts is, at the forefront of doing so many really good things, there's always room for improvement. And this is one of them in particular.
Now is this a standalone bill or is this going to be an amendment to the current law that's on the books?
This is a standalone bill. So what it would do is it would edit the laws that we have in place. So technically it would amend the laws we have in place, but what we're trying to do is get this passed as a standalone bill. And since the point in time that we proposed this, Kevin, we have had many, many, many people come forward and say the same thing happened to them, or that they were too afraid to come forward, or that they had this evidence and it was a smoking gun, but they couldn't use it. It's really unfortunate that we haven't been able to update our laws to stay current with the technology that we have literally at our fingertips, and to be able to use this to make sure that individuals are protected and that people feel comfortable.
Yeah, and we're speaking with State Senator Patrick O'Connor. He is our guest. Let's take a moment to talk about things going on within your district. One of them, the state champion Duxbury High School girls team, actually had a chance to come up to the State House. What was that like?
It was awesome. Honestly, one of the things that I take a lot of pride in is being able to bring our local high school champions up to the State House. Similar to the way that our national champions get to go to the White House and celebrate with them, I thought it was cool to be able to institute a policy in my office where if anyone wins in the district, that we have them up to the State House. We take them a tour of the State House. We try and get them civically engaged and talk about the things that they care about in that regard. We recognize them in front of our colleagues. They bring the trophy in. We take a lot of pictures. And then after that, we treat them to lunch. And so it's something that is really special. And you get to meet so many amazing people. I mean, our school districts all across the South Shore are filled with remarkably intelligent young people who really, in my opinion, give me so much faith and confidence in the future, because they have such a wealth of knowledge that goes far beyond. I know when I was, you know, their age 15, 20 plus years ago, you know, just where their heads are at now compared to where mine was, and all the information and technology that they have available to them. It gives me a lot of hope for future generations, because they are incredible people.
On my list here, I see that the 15th annual Weymouth School Day Games. Now, is this something that has already taken place? And were you a judge, or were you a witness, or were you just visiting during the day?
So last week we had the Special Olympics 15th annual games in Weymouth, and I go every single year. I have been doing this since I was on the city council in Weymouth.
Fantastic.
And we have a procession that we lead down, all the student athletes, and then from there I stay for a few of the competitions, and I'm able to be one of the people who presents medals to some of our student athletes after they participate. So I love doing it. And then last week we were at We Are Marshfield on Friday. We were out there thanking just the students for participating in that. 311 people, students and volunteers, were at like 30 different locations across Marshfield, and they were doing cleanup efforts. And I think that they had said something like well over 1,000 hours of community service. And it's just, it's important for me to be out there to recognize this stuff, because there's so much good that's happening throughout our district, from, you know, champion athletes to Special Olympics going on, to students and community coming together to beautify and make their little part of the South Shore better. It's just it's a special place. I always say this every time that I'm on here. I feel so honored to be able to represent this part of the Commonwealth inside the legislature. And, you know, it's important for me to be out there and see what's going on, because a lot of these things, you know, when we talked about drug-induced homicide and wiretap, those happen to constituents. Yep. And if we're not out there in the community, we're not talking to constituents and people, you know, day in and day out, we might not get that viewpoint. And I want that viewpoint, and I want to bring that to Beacon Hill and be, you know, the voice of the people here on the South Shore, because there's a lot of good that comes down here, and we want to spread that across the state.
Well, Senator, as always, I want to thank you and your team for always finding the time with your busy schedule to be able to join me and talk to the listeners here on 95.9 WATD, whether it's on this radio program or other programs, just to let them know what's going on with their state government.
Absolutely. Thank you, Kevin. I appreciate you being a voice, bringing so much community news to folks here on the South Shore.
There he is, State Senator Patrick O'Connor, joining us for this portion of Monday Night Talk. We're going to step aside just for a moment, and when we come back,
is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
Antique car restorers regard the 32 Ford Highboy as the ultimate street rod. The average person sees the same flame-red, low-to-the-ground, funny-looking hot rod as a toy, which it is. A toy with 427 cubic inches under the hood, convertible top, chop-and-channel windshield, the seat genuine vinyl, an innovation in 32. The convertible top, though, is canvas and needs to be stretched to fit. It snaps onto the windshield with enough tension to pull out all the wrinkles. Saturday morning, July 6, that stored tension was fully released when the 1932 windshield cracked simultaneously at both bottom corners.
I could have cried. The older I get, the more I appreciate antiques. I'm Tiny of Tiny & Sons Glass. We come to your work or your workplace and replace your windshield. Any year, any model, from 1901 to tomorrow.
My dad did a great job. 1-888-64-TINIES. Just call.
Download the Monday Night Talk podcast from iTunes for free. Just search for Monday Night Talk WATD. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD. As you have been reminded earlier in the program that this is an abbreviated version of Monday Night Talk, as there is a political forum coming up at the top of the hour. But right now we have an opportunity to talk a little bit about the James Library and Center for the Arts. Fun, right? We have Megan Ward. She is the executive director. She's joining us. We get to find out a little bit about her and what they do over at the library. How are you, Megan?
I'm so good. Thank you so much for having me tonight.
Let's start off. What are some of the things that happen at the James Library and the Center for the Arts?
So the James Library and Center for the Arts is a really incredible little building. It's right in the heart of Norwell Center. It was built in 1874. And it's beautiful Italianate architecture. And when you walk in, there's such a positive energy to the space. You walk in on the library level, and if you were to go upstairs, we have this amazing concert hall with a Steinway B grand piano. And then if you were to go downstairs, we have this newly renovated, brightly lit, gorgeous art gallery. So it's a small space, but it has a huge impact. And in the 90s, it was repurposed from a library into an art center. So at that time, Norwell was, I guess, really in need of some arts and some really high quality programming arts, so that people didn't have to travel all the way into Boston to see, you know, world-class arts programming. And we started off at that time with some literary teas, so they would have some authors and book discussions. And we actually had BSO performers come down and lead these incredible concerts. So right in Norwell, it was just amazing. And it, over the years, it's evolved. And we now have anywhere between 4 and 10 concerts a year. We usually have several different author events. We have music lessons that take place every day of the week, choral lessons that take place. And then we have rotating art gallery shows and exhibitions that come through September through June. So our mission is to inspire creativity and an appreciation for the arts through visual, musical, and literary programming. You know, and we try to do it on a budget. We try to make sure that we are aware and respectful of people's budgets. So we have a lot of free programming and very affordable ticket prices. I think the highest ticket price we typically offer is $35 and maybe a $50 ticket for a very special event. But yeah, that's what we do. And I like to think we're pretty good at it.
Let me ask you, what is it like to be the director of such a intriguing space? And knowing that there's so many things that are going on.
Yeah, well, I think it's one of the most exciting things about being the director at the James. There's always something new. So if jazz isn't really your thing, well, don't worry. Just wait a month and we have a classical concert coming up, or a bluegrass concert, or a Celtic concert. Or, you know, if you'd like to learn a little bit about the snowstorm in 78, we just had Harvey Leonard come. And, you know, there's always something different. There's always something new. There's always new people and faces walking through the door. So it's an exciting place. It's an exciting place to be.
We should talk a little bit about this coming weekend. I can't believe it's already Mother's Day weekend is just a few days ahead of us here on the 12th and the 13th. And you actually, there are going to be some things taking place at the library and Center for the Arts.
Yes. So we have an incredible exhibition coming up, and it's by an artist named Sarah Hutt. And she has shown this wonderful show all over the country, Colorado, Texas, New Hampshire, New Jersey, you know, New York, all over the place. And it's called My Mother's Legacy. And when Sarah was 13, she lost her mother to breast cancer. Her mother at the time was 47. And she found that over the years, she was forgetting pieces. There was little fragments that, you know, she would remember and others that she would forget. And so one of the things that she did was she wrote down everything that she could remember about her mother. And as a sculptor and mixed media sculptor and artist, she turned it into a 1,000-line poem. And it's a 1,000-line poem burned into the bottom of 1,000 wooden bowls. And the reason she did that, I know, it's very cool, right? Very different. So the reason she did that is because her mother was known for turning over things, objects, to find out where they were made. And so when the person comes into the art gallery, all the bowls are piled sort of haphazardly, and you have to pick them up and turn them over. It's very experiential, it's very tactile, and it's meant to, you know, evoke feelings of, you know, happiness and loss and all these different things. I mean, it's art, it's provocative, and we love that about this exhibition. We're so excited to have it. So, that's my mother's legacy. And then on top of that, we are going to be having a cabaret weekend. Mm. So it's a big fundraiser for the James. And I should mention that my mother's legacy is totally free. Everybody's welcome to come. The cabarets are a big fundraiser for the James, and we have 16 different performers, a Grammy Award-winning pianist playing for these performers, as well as some other, you know, guest stars that will be surprises. So Friday night and Saturday night, you'll hear songs from, you know, Christina Perry and Billy Joel, and then classics like, you know, you might hear some Broadway standards. You might hear some things from Hamilton or Cabaret or Song and Dance and Songs for a New World. And it's going to be such a fun event. So we have people from all over the South Shore, different local celebrities, if you will, and then people from farther, from Maryland and, you know, from different states coming in to surprise people and really just serenade them with incredible vocals.
I want to digress back to the bowls. What's intriguing me right now is that 1,000 bowls, and this is a 1,000 line poem that's etched.
Yes.
So you basically have to start at bowl one and work your way around to be able to experience the entire poem.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, absolutely. So you could stop in every week to drop your child off for a vocal lesson and take 10 minutes and go downstairs and pick up one set of bowls. And then the next week you can come back and do the other side of the gallery and pick up another set of bowls, and you could keep going until, you know, until you're through all of them. It's a very, very cool exhibition. It really is.
What is the length of time that an exhibition is within the center?
Yeah, so this one is going to open Friday, May 12th, mm-hmm. and we're going to have an open house that day from 1 to 7. If you'd like to come from 5 to 7, you can actually meet the artist. So Sarah will be there. You can chat with her about her inspiration, some of the other work she does. She's got an incredible history, and it's all, you can check it out on our website, which is jameslibrary.org. But she is going to have her work in our gallery through June 17th. So opens on May 12th. Going to close on June 17th. And again, like I said, it's sponsored by the Cordelia Family Foundation so that we can keep it free for everyone.
Again, if you're just tuning in, you are tuned into Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD. We get the great Megan Wart. She is the executive director of the James Library and Center for the Arts, talking a little bit about not only the exhibit that they have, My Mother's Legacy. Think of it, 1,000 bowls etched. There's 1,000 line poem etched across these bowls. You're looking for something to do up until June 17th? This might be the ideal thing to do. And again, it is free. Also talking about Star Factor here, Lenny Williams, who is a Grammy and Emmy Award-winning composer, is actually going to be selling tickets. There's tickets to be sold a cabaret weekend, May 12th and 13th. Now, what are the ticket prices for this? And is it just strictly a general admission, or is there kind of like a VIP type of a ticket as well?
Yeah, so we have general admission, which is going to be theater-style seating. Those are going to be $35 tickets. And then we have some VIP, they're limited seats, which we rented, you know, low-top cabaret seating, you know, as you might see in a piano bar in New York City. So we have those VIP tickets for $50. And like I said, those are limited. Some of them are already sold. So if you're interested in those, they'll be right up front, right next to the performers, right next to the piano. And they're going to be, you know, you can't have a bad seat at the James. It's a small theater. It's a small space.
It's
and
cozy.
The acoustics are incredible.
It's cozy.
Yes, incredibly cozy. Just it's such a cool vibe, you know?
What goes into picking an artist like Mr. Williams. This is somebody who he's composed, what, original music for over 600 documentary films.
He's wonderful. And he's a friend of the James.
Oh.
And he's such a cool guy. You should have him on sometime because he's such a cool guy. He actually played piano for Ava Cassidy.
Wow.
So the recordings that you hear of Ava Cassidy, that's him. He's so impressive. And he kind of came to us with this idea and we were like, yes, let's do it. Let's run with it. So that's kind of where it came from. And Donna Maar, our musical director, these two great minds came together. And this is sort of where it came from. We've been talking about doing a cabaret for a while. And this year it kind of finally came to fruition. So we're really excited about it.
And is this something that we could see Mr. Williams back at the library?
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to see how this one goes this year. We're going to see how well attended and how people receive it. I mean, honestly, the talent that's going to be in the room, I can't imagine anybody would walk away unhappy. Honestly, these people are incredible. So we're going to see how it goes. And then, you know, this could be an every year thing or maybe an every other year thing. We're not sure. But at the James, we try to keep the programming fresh. So we try to change things up every year, every season. And so we'll see how it goes.
Now, is Mr. Williams, does he know all of these local stars who are coming in and performing? Has he worked with them before, or how did it all come together like this?
Well, so some people he's worked with, some people are also friends of the James, some people it's kind of word of mouth. Oh, I know a person, you know, she's amazing. She just started this theater company in Scituate. Let's talk to her, you know, just all different things. You know, and that's kind of how it works in the theater world sometimes. It's not a huge community. And somebody knows somebody who I was in a show with one time. And so we are going to be having rehearsals. All the performers are going to be rehearsing with Lenny the week before the show. Everybody's been working on their own individually and getting everybody's music to Lenny. And then we will have probably a final rehearsal right before. And then it's showtime.
Have you had a chance to see any of the rehearsals or see anybody, any of the performances?
So not yet. I am going to be performing myself, though. My background is actually in musical theater, so this is a sweet spot for me. So I've either worked with some of the people or I've heard them, but I have not heard their specific pieces they'll be working on for this. So it's going to be fun.
So, oh yeah, look at your name's right in here. I didn't see this.
Yeah,
that's
me.
So funny.
Yeah.
So what would you say? So you're somebody who loves musical theater as well.
Yeah.
What have you performed? What have you performed in music? Are you a community theater kind of a person or somebody who did it in high school, college?
Yeah, I went to University of New Hampshire. I did musical theater there, and then I toured both regionally and did some national work, and then I just kind of stepped away. But I've been in a lot of different shows.
You gotta have a favorite.
My favorite, you know, I was in Footloose a couple times and I was Rusty, so I got to sing Let's Hear It for the Boy. And that was a favorite role for me. I was also Meg Brockie in Brigadoon, which was a really fun character role, and just good songs and working with good people. And it's always a new show, even though it's the same show. It's always a new show. It's a new audience. It's different energy. It's, you know, it's fun.
I have to tell you that I feel enlightened because, you know, knowing that, you know, that your organization exists. I want to thank a good friend, Michelle McGrath. I put the onus on her. She was the one who said, hey, could you do something in regards to the James Library and the Center for the Arts? And sometimes she sends me a lot of stuff because she's always promoting a lot of different items. And this was just one of those things that resonated with me. I'm somebody I know of the Company Theater in Norwell.
Yeah. Yeah.
And now to know that the James, you know, has performances and has features different items like My Mother's Legacy, you know, an art exhibit. I feel enlightened.
Yeah, well, I'm so glad. And that's what we're all about. You know, sometimes people drive by the James and they're like, oh, I thought this was a private, you know, club, or I've never been in here. And I actually love it when people say things like that, because I'm like, let me give you a tour. I mean, you'll meet some of the nicest people when you walk through the doors of the James. And I mean, Michelle's one of those people. She's been a friend of the James for longer than I've been there. I've been there 8 years, and she's been around much longer than me. So it's just a really special place. And thank you so much for the opportunity to tell people about it, because a lot of people don't know. It's like a little hidden gem. And we love it when new people walk through the doors.
Now, is there some kind of like a friend of the James Library and Center for the Arts? Or is there, if folks want to have, is there a membership to be a part of the library?
No, there's no membership. So if you wanted to come in and take out a book and you live in Scituate or you live in Hanover or Cohasset or whatever, anybody can come in and take out a book. It works just like the public library.
No.
So you would take it out for 2 weeks. If you want to buy tickets, you know, we have our website, jameslibrary.org. And we also do about once or twice a month, we do a constant contact. We send out emails to folks. We do a lot. We're pretty active on social media. So there's all different ways to follow us and find out about what we're doing. And there's no membership, which is kind of, again, goes back to keeping things accessible. And I also want to mention that it's a historic building, but in 2019, we actually completed a handicap accessibility project. So we have a handicap entrance, we have handicap parking, we have a handicap bathroom, and we have an elevator. So if you have any mobility issues at all, you're still able to access all the great things that we do at the James on any level. So
if you want to find out more about the James Library and Center for the Arts, you check out their website, www.jameslibrary.com. .org is the fast and easy way to do it. Is there a newsletter or no?
An e-newsletter, yeah. And you can sign up right on our website.
There you go. So there's all the details. If you're looking for something great to do with your mom, or maybe you're a mom and you have a friend of mom's, stop on by the James Library and Center for the Arts. A couple of, not only an art exhibit, but also it's two nights for a cabaret weekend. Megan, I want to thank you so much for being my guest.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Now, you understand that you're going to have to become a regular on the show, right? That's
how it works. I'd be happy to.
Awesome. And if we could find a way to get Mr. Williams to do an interview, you would also have to sit in on that.
Absolutely. I will talk to him. You bet.
Awesome. So, again, we have been speaking with the great Megan Ward, Executive Director of the James Library and Center for the Arts. And again, if you're looking for something to do for Mother's Day week and something special, again, check out the website, okay? The jameslibrary.org. That's all the time that they have allotted me, because it's a shortened show. A political forum coming up in just a few moments. Till next week at 6:15 p.m., you've been tuned in to Monday Night Talk right here on 95.9 WATD.